From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches people's lives. I am your host, Dr. Obi D.K. Kamau, and on today's show, we focus on Native American Heritage Month and the National Day of Mourning.
We fought in your wars in other countries. Our Navajo Nation code talkers served and saved this nation in World War II. We have the inalienable right to joint venture with whom we choose as long as we do not harm nor commit fraud upon anyone.
We'll hear Russell Means, who helped take over Wounded Knee in 1973, speak to the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Indian Affairs in 1989. We'll have the opportunity to listen to that testimony.
Metacomber King Philip being beheaded, having his head stuck on a spear and set up as on a post out in the outskirts of one of their villages to send a signal to Native people. But we won't talk about terrorism, right? No, we won't talk about the use of terrorism against Native.
John Kane, WPFW's own, hosts the show Let's Talk Native, and he questions why are we still allowing our oppressors to define us in the past tense. He shares several hard truths about National Native American Heritage Month.
The Gwich'in Nation elders and chiefs gathered because of the threat of oil and gas into Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Bernadette Dementor, who's the executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee, speaks here about her people's ancestral bond and protection of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the implications of the Trump administration opening it up to oil and gas companies for exploration and development. We begin COVID, Race, and Democracy in memoriam. John Trudell hosted the broadcast of Radio Free Alcatraz live from Alcatraz Island in December 1969. The island was taken over by Native Americans who identified themselves as Indians of all tribes. The takeover lasted for 19 months. Radio Free Alcatraz was broadcast through the Pacifica Network. We now go into the archives to listen to Al Silverwitz interview John in 1969 from Alcatraz Island.
I stayed on a reservation until I was about five or six, and then my family moved. And I went back in 1961, 15 I think. And I stayed there until the summer of 1963 when I joined the Navy and I left. I stayed in the Navy for 4 years. After I got out of the Navy, I went to work as a shoe salesman. That lasted about 4 months, and then I quit to go to school, which I was doing when the Alcatraz movement took place. So I dropped all my studies and moved up here. Much more satisfying than sitting in school learning. Time to put into practice a little of what I picked up the last couple of years.
How old are you, John?
23.
And you have a family, I understand.
Yes, I have two little girls, and we're expecting in August.
Are all of you living on the island now?
Yes. We've been living on the island since, I guess it would be about the 5th of December. I came up the last weekend in November to kind of check the situation out, and I liked what I saw, so I went back to San Bernardino and got my family and kind of just dropped everything there and relocated up here.
There's not much in the way of food or water, and electricity is intermittent, to say the best, and there's no telephone service and so on.
I know the GSA and the Public Health Department made the statement one time that they were going to have to rip us off the island because of improper sanitation facilities. But if they're going to take us off the island out there for that, then I think they're going to have to improve conditions on the reservations, because although we have no central heating and we haven't got any steady electricity here, water is a problem. When the Army stops giving us water, then we're going to run into some hassles. But even with all these problems, it's the same as being on the reservation. I've had people say that, well, it's really courageous for you people to be doing this. But we've all been through it before, just a different place. It's the same game, just has a different name now. Alcatraz is nothing but a rock to many people, but it's our rock. And we can develop it and we can make things work for the Indian people. So it's more than just a rock to us. It's maybe a stepping stone to a better future. Well, I'd say that the Alcatraz movement is, with what we have with Alcatraz, we have a chance to unite the American Indian people as they've never been united before or never had the opportunity to do. Because when we were still fighting with the United States government, the government put in a policy in effect that they would break down the Indian people so that they would never become a threat, never be able to fight the United States government again. And part of this program was to break down the Indian nations, break down the tribes, break down the families, break down the individuals, give us nothing constructive to do, and then time will take care of the rest.
And also to exploit the divisions between the tribes. The
yes,
fact that there
it's
were so
just
many small
pit
groups.
Man against man, and family against family, tribe against tribe, because there are many tribes in the United States, and many of us East Coast Indians didn't know anything about the Plains Indians or they about the West Coast Indians. So, I mean, we have many cultural different backgrounds, just the way we were situated geographically. It's been easy for the government to, once they accomplish this, taking children away from their families and sending them off to schools, so to break down the family unity, tore down our religion, took everything we had except our pride in being Indian, something they can't take. I like to think we've never been defeated. Maybe we've been stopped for a while, but we haven't been defeated. And I think this is one way of showing it. You can kick a dog so long, and then the dog's either going to die or get up and bite you, and we're not ready to die.
John Trudell became chairman of the American Indian Movement from 1973 to 1979. He had some tragedy in his life. His wife, Tina, was pregnant with her fourth child. Their three living children at the time were ages 1, 3, and 5. His wife, Tina's mother, and their children were burned to death in a fire of suspicious origin at his in-laws' home in Nevada. The fire happened hours after he burned an American flag in protest on the steps of the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. His father-in-law was badly burned. The fire was never investigated. Sometimes after this, John began his poetry career. This is another piece from the Pacifica Archives. It's John Trudell in 1992.
If I say anything that you don't agree with, it's just a difference of opinion. Because I've been watching this stuff go on about the elections. And see, I equate this whole election thing to like the Berlin Wall coming down. See, and everyone was happy because they had freedom. See, but economic collapse followed their wall coming down. See, and I look here in America, and I think, I wonder if people really understand what's happening here. But the realities, the baby boomers have now seized the symbols of political power, the White House, just by age. I mean, just the natural flow of events. At some point in history, we would, through the aging process, start to fill these positions. And so we've now reached a point where we have the symbols of political power, such as the White House. But there's another reality here. The other reality is about economic power. And in the 60s, when we rebelled, we were young and idealistic and said we wanted a better way. So we did whatever we could. We were young, idealistic, not experienced. But that rebellion came because basically the whites were more affluent than they had ever been before. And out of that affluency, they wanted to become kinder as a culture. And when Warmaker, Predator, understood the reality of this, and they looked at the numbers, we were the baby boom, we were the majority, we are the majority, but we were the majority for the next 40 years. We were the workforce. They had to subdue us because we were then and still to this day remain dangerous. But what they did was they started a redistribution of the wealth because it's based upon affluency.
for the whites. So the redistribution of the wealth took place through the form of what they called the first energy crisis. And they put Nixon out there for everyone to worry about government, criminality in government, and no one was paying attention. No one was paying attention to the fact that the cost of living in the country just kind of basically doubled. And they blamed it on the Arabs, and no one paid attention to the fact that the energy companies made untold, unimaginable dollars worth of profits. And no one asked any questions. But it was the first step towards the redistribution of the wealth, because we, at some point, by aging, are going to assume certain positions, just however the poll is. The second redistribution point of the wealth was when they deregulated the savings and loan, and they call it a scandal. But what it was an act of treason. It was a political crime with a criminal mask, looting the national treasury of the United States, and the pouring of money into war and aggressive behavior. They have created these, what they call these trillion-dollar debts. It's the neon fiefdom, and the forms of social patterns have changed, and the generations have changed. But this thing that has been feeding off of the essence of the human beings for the last, I don't know, it's thousands of years now. Columbus came to the Western Hemisphere. Columbus, it was not about, to us, it's not about discovery. It's not about whether he was a good man or a bad man. To me, the reality is he was a disease. And the disease, it's like a diseased spirit. And the disease of this spirit lives in the mindset. It affects how one perceives reality.
Activist, poet, actor John Trudell passed away on December 8, 2015. Special thanks to the Pacifica Archives for their contribution to this story. Bernadette Dementev is the executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. She speaks here about the Gwich'in people's ancestral bond and protection of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The refuge is internationally known for its ecological importance, beauty, and for its wildlife. 8.9 million acres are protected as wilderness with the 1.5 million acre coastal plain, which serves as its biological heart. After a rushed approval process, the Trump administration has opened up the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge to oil and gas exploration and development. This violates the human rights of the Gwich'in people.
My name is Bernadette Dementev. I'm the executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. We represent 15 communities throughout Alaska and Canada, and I am from Fort Yukon, which is 8 miles above the Arctic Circle. The Gwich'in Nation have had a spiritual and cultural connection to the porcupine caribou herd since time immemorial. Protection of the birthing and nursing grounds is a human rights issue. The caribou are the foundation of our culture and our spirituality. They provide food, clothing, and tools, and they are the basis of our song stories and our dances. There was a time when we were able to communicate with them, and we made a vow to take care of each other. The Arctic Refuge is known to my people as Jikwatsun Gondaigotlit, the sacred place where life begins. It is not just a piece of land with oil underneath it. And first, I want to explain that just because I'm here, it does not make my voice more important. Everything I know comes from my elders, from my leaders, and from prayer. I speak for the Gwich'in Nation and the many Alaskans and Americans who oppose development into Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This place has been sacred to the Gwich'in since time immemorial. The caribou that migrate through there every year are the source of our food, identity, and spirituality. Our creation story tells us that there was a time that we were able to communicate. I'm here to let people know that it's not always easy to travel across the country into different environments asking people for help, because our elected leadership in Alaska listens to the corporations over the indigenous voices. Scientists from around the world warn us that this is not the right move to make. But I could have told you that, because my elders are my scientists, and they have warned us of this in 1988, actually, at the very first Gwich'in gathering that was held in over 150 years. The Gwich'in Nation elders and chiefs gathered because of the threat of oil and gas into Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We are real people. We are mothers, we are fathers, we have jobs. We are not asking for anything for the ability to live and thrive off the land that Creator blessed us with. I am not an environmentalist or an activist. I am a mother. I am a grandmother who is concerned about the future of my children. We will never stop defending our way of life. Jonathan Solomon, one of my former board members, he told me, you know, one time I was traveling and I was speaking at an event and there was scientists and doctors and, you know, all these big people, and I felt out of place. And an elder, she came up and she stuck her hand on my shoulder and she told me that, believe in yourself, your ancestors are with you. Right then and there, I remembered what Jonathan told me. He said, I went to the third grade and I've been standing up to one of the biggest governments in the world. If you have it in your heart, you have it. And I'm here to tell you, it is our responsibility as human beings to take care of this land, to take care of our water, to take care of our animals. Our animals cannot speak. They cannot tell us that they are sick, that they are starving. They cannot tell us that we are hurting their habitat. We have a responsibility to our future generations. Whether you're indigenous, white, black, we have a responsibility to keep a healthy environment for our future generations. It frustrates me that regardless of this 30-year fight that we've had with this government, that we still have to, 2020, and we still have to go out and fight to keep our land sacred. Our elders, they told us to go out and tell the world that we are here to do it in a good way and not to compromise our position. That do it in a good way, that is a very simple sentence, but it's not always easy, especially when we are up against so much dishonesty and misleading statements from our own government. And so today I ask you to stand with the Gwich'in Nation, protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, learn about us. This is not just about a wilderness. Of course, we are all interconnected up here to our land, water, and animals. And if our animals and our land is sick, then we are sick. But I just want everybody to know that there's a lot of work behind my voice. That, you know, everything I know does come from my elders, and there's a lot of people that you do not see. I'm proud to be Gwich'in, and I just want to remind everybody, you know, our ancestors, they worked hard for us to be here. They survived some of the coldest, harshest winters so that we could be here. We owe that same dedication and respect to our future ancestors. On behalf of my people, Masit Cho and Apasi, thank you.
That was Bernadette Demento, Executive Director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. Lenny Foster is an Indigenous rights activist with a long history of protecting rights to Indigenous spiritual practices. He has served as spiritual counselor for many imprisoned Indigenous people.
It's been real bad here in the Navajo Reservation for March this year, and it was very bad there for a while until they implemented the stay-at-home policy. no gatherings, no sweat lodge ceremonies, no POD ceremonies, no family gatherings. But of course, people sometimes don't adhere to that, and that's what results in a lot of a surge in the coronavirus. We're experiencing a surge, so every weekend for 3 weeks straight, we're in a strict lockdown. Then during the week, we're in a curfew from evening, 8 p.m. in the evening till 5 a.m. the next morning. And I myself, on a personal level, have lost four friends to coronavirus, so I've been in a lot of grief over that. Other people are maybe not as fortunate because they live further out. I live right in a small community. I worked for the Navajo Nation for 37 years, so I retired here 2 years ago, so I was able to purchase a new home, and the home that I purchased has electricity and running water, so I'm fortunate in that respect, because a lot of our people don't have running water or electricity. Many of our young people are incarcerated in the State Department of Corrections, the state prisons, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Montana, South Dakota, Minnesota, places like that, where you have large populations of Native Americans. And also the Federal Bureau of Prisons. I had over 2,000 young Natives as clients. And I mentioned I worked in the prison system from 1981 to 2018. And at that time, I had visited a total of 96 state and federal prisons to provide spiritual counseling. My main responsibilities was to visit these prisons with substantial numbers of Native Americans and conduct sweat lodge ceremonies, pipe ceremonies, talk in circle, and visit individuals on administrative segregation and or death row. My responsibility and priority to advocate for their religious, cultural, spiritual rights, and that sustain their humanity and their sanity. It was very important for our people to have that connection to outside spiritual advisors and spiritual leaders. And I served that function. I enjoyed that very much. And many of these experiences resulted in either litigation, courts, to get the rights established within the prison system, or state legislation, federal legislation, which was to go through the state government and the federal government to establish the statutes, the policies. And one of my most notable client that I had for 35 years was Leonard Peltier, the foremost Native political prisoner in the United States prison system. It began in the United States Penitentiary, Leavenworth, Kansas. Now at this time, he's incarcerated in the United States Penitentiary, Coleman, Florida. Maximum security. It was difficult because the prison officials don't want to see that opportunity for Leonard Peltier to have spiritual visits. The late Archie Fire, a Lakota elder named David Chief. So there's three. He's had three spiritual leaders through the years, Archie Fire, David Chief, and myself. Said it's been rewarding, very rewarding for me, but also we advocated for his right while he was incarcerated and helped his humanity and maintain his sanity. Because he's been locked up for 44 years. That's a long time. And he's 76 years old. And he's experiencing some bad health. He's got heart problems, high blood pressure, diabetes. So, and then his prostate. So he has numerous health issues. that we've been working to have him release on executive clemency, and it's been perhaps one of the most difficult cases to work with, and I've been working with the, his committee that also advocate for his release, and now we have an attorney named Kevin Sharp, who's very actively working to seek his release. He's isolated himself, wearing a mask, doesn't venture too far from his cell because of the coronavirus that are in these prisons. And USP Coleman, Florida is infected with the coronavirus, so he's very anxious. Very difficult for him because he's been cut off from any visits or any phone calls. And I myself would visit him once or twice a year to provide him with the spiritual, the Native American church prayer service has been canceled for the most part. He's been locked down for the last 6-8 months. Best I can do from here is to pray for him every morning, smoke the pipe, include him in my prayer, and I'm looking forward to 2021, where I can go visit him, sit with him, and smoke the pipe and pray with him. The last couple of years that I was able to visit him, we only visited in the visiting room. The warden wouldn't allow the sweat lodge ceremonies. We just have to do the best we can under the conditions that exist for us.
Lenny Foster, longtime Indigenous prison rights activist.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Indigenous people, shine your light, we are equal. I remember the days when our prayers were illegal. I remember the days when being Indian was lethal. Yeah, we had a rough past, but get ready for the sequel. Get ready for the glorious comeback of our people. Oh, yeah.
Lila June Johnson is next. Lila June is an Indigenous environmental scientist, doctoral student, educator, community organizer, and musician of Dene, Cheyenne, and European lineage. She lives in Taos, New Mexico. Here she speaks about her journey to find herself from the Conference of Hope. Lila June Johnson has stated that her personal goal is learning how to love more deeply.
Rise up, all you warriors of love, all you answers to the prayers of our ancestors from above. I can feel it in my heart. Can you feel it in your blood? I can hear the seventh fire calling us to wake up, wake up. All nations rise, rise up, cause now's your time.
Yat e shike do shidene she e Lila June yenishye, nanesht ejit hachit nishli. Greetings. Where the sky kisses the earth, my people, my kin. My name is Lila June. I'm of the Black Charcoal Streak clan on my mother's side. My father's mother's of the Cheyenne clan. My mother's father is of the Salt clan. Aro Scottish Scandinavian. My father's father's clan is Scottish Scandinavian. I think. In this manner, I present myself as a Dene woman. Taos, New Mexico is where I walked around growing up. Today I live in Albuquerque. Perhaps one of the greatest questions of our times, how do we return to self? How do we return home to who we are? My elders have often taught me, and by the way, I feel a little sheepish speaking first as a younger person, but I have got the blessing from the group to do so. But my elders have said, we are working very hard to help you be all that you are. We are working very hard to help you see the beauty of all that you are. and to shed the labels of all that you are not. And that has been a wonderful journey for me as a woman who experienced a lot of drug addiction, experienced a lot of abuse that women should never go through, experienced a lot of poverty and all kinds of things that made me feel like I wasn't all that good. And I internalized a lot of the abuse that I experienced as an adolescent, teenager, and college student. I thought I was a bad person. Because of all these bad things have happened to me, I thought maybe it's because I'm not that special or something. Many different rivers came together to make me. I have Dene ancestry, I have Cheyenne ancestry, I have European ancestry. And so I was born into this battle. And the Navajo word for European person, it's a new word. I don't think it's really a word from our truest tongue, but it's Belagana, which means the enemy. And so how can I walk in this world if I am my own enemy? How can I walk in this world if I am half Native American and half European? How can I come home to self if I'm at war with myself all the time? And so that process of reconciling the rivers within me has been an exquisite journey that I am so happy to share with you. I did a lot of journeying in Dene way. I got this belt when I was 14, when I had my first menstrual blood. We had a four-day ceremony for me. They rooted me into the earth. They taught me my responsibilities, how to be a generous woman, how to be a kind woman, how to be a humble woman, how to serve the people, how to be a mother of all. All of these lessons are woven into this belt. And I was lucky enough to have a tribe that still had these womanhood ceremonies, which we all need to bring back, by the way, no matter who you are, where you're from. We all need to bring this back for our young women and our young men. I had to do some homework on the European side, right? Because there was so much lost on the journey here. And so I started to research the indigenous cultures of Europe. And I started to become curious of who am I? Researching that European side really showed me a lot of hardships that our people went through as Europeans. Just like Native Americans here, in Wales, you could have a big block of wood tied around your neck if you got caught speaking Welsh. You would have written on it WN, which stood for Welsh Knot. And the Scottish had goat skulls on their necks, the Gaelic language. And furthermore, you have the Hungarian language and the burning of the people in Hungary who were not converting. Because the Cree say that a nation is not defeated until the hearts of the women are on the ground. The women of Europe and the things that they went through in the 1500s, around that time, and the persecution of about 6 to 9 million women is what they estimate. 6 to 9 million of our grandmothers burned alive, drowned alive, raped, beaten, tortured, dismembered alive as so-called witches, right? But these were not witches, or rather they were, because witch actually means wise woman. But these were not evil women. These were the medicine women of Europe. These are the women who knew how to pray with the stones. These were the women who knew where the sacred sites were. These were the women who knew what the sacred plants were. And these are the women whose knowledge was burned along with them. And so I went on a journey to recover that knowledge, and I was continuing that journey. And we have to understand this is not just an assault on the women, it's an assault on the men who love them as well. If you scratch beneath the surface and if you go past that thin wall of time that dominates our understanding of European history, you will find a great plethora of indigenous cultures that honored the feminine, honored the goddess, honored the earth, and so much so that they found in German soil in 2009, they found this little figurine of the fertility goddess. She radiocarbon dated back to 40,000 years old. This is how long our people have been honoring the earth and honoring women. We have to take a moment to forgive ourselves for our trespasses and remember that if you dig deep enough, you will see how beautiful we really are. And that's all the ancestors have been asking me to do, is see how beautiful you really are. And so I invite you now to just take a moment. Let's just pray for those grandmothers of Europe and say thank you for all of the hardships that they endured, and to remember their husbands, remember their sons, remember their brothers, their uncles, and honor them too. That's who we are. Hey.
Lila June is an indigenous environmental scientist, doctoral student, educator, community organizer, and musician of Dene, Cheyenne, and European lineage.
Wake all nations, rise. Rise up, 'cause now's your time. We don't have to hide anymore, 'cause now's the time. All nations rise. Rise up, 'cause now's your time.
Russell Means, an ancestor and icon, is an Oglala Lakota from the Pine Ridge Reservation who served as the first national director of the American Indian Movement and was one of the organization's best-known spokespeople. Means was involved in the 1969 occupation of San Francisco's Alcatraz Island. In 1973, he helped lead the AIM takeover of Wounded Knee. Both events brought worldwide attention to the injustices and privation faced by indigenous people. We'll hear Russell's testimony to the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Indian Affairs in
1989. This is a traditional greeting of my people that I am bound to give, albeit it's a short version. Hello, my relatives. I am an Oglala Lakota, and I come from our very sacred holy land, the Black Hills, where Yellow Thunder Village is. My mother is from the War Eagle clan, and my father's family is from the Crazy Horse clan. Senators, my morning prayers to the great mystery always include you and your colleagues in Congress, as well as leaders in all governments. It is an honor to come before you as a spokesman for my people. In these United States of America, this great country of ours, we American Indians, we can be anything we want to be, except American Indians. And that is created by the laws of this nation and condoned by its subsidiaries, the so-called tribal government, and designed for the Indian to fail, to be expendable, to be eliminated. I take you back in your history. After the American Indian hostiles had been subdued and forcibly confined to Indian reservations, it took approximately 30 years, one generation, for us to adjust and become economically viable. Contrary to what the anthropologists say and what we even ourselves are taught as Indian people. However, allotments were made smaller, our remaining lands were open to homesteading, and we were forced into reducing our livestock. Nevertheless, we made the adjustment again in less than half the aforementioned time. 15 years and become economically self-sufficient again. But once again, the American Indian was forced into reducing our livestock. The boss farmer concept was instituted. We were told what, when, where, how much, and how little we could grow. This applied to agriculture and our livestock. Again, we recovered in a time span of approximately 15 years. We were so successful in our third recovery that the American Indians enjoyed the finest of economic times, while the rest of the industrialized world was wallowing in the Great Depression. It was then that President Roosevelt introduced the Howard Wheeler Act, better known as the Indian Reorganization Act, the IRA, which institutionalized the so-called tribal governments, which are not one of our institutions, and it is still foreign to us this very day. We have yet to recover. 45 years later, the IRA, Indian tribal governments, on their own initiative, began renewed efforts at reestablishing their sovereignty, focused on the oldest profession of American Indians. That's gambling. Bingo and other gaming operations has been, without exception, a proven initial success. The United States government, through Congress, once again intervenes to regulate a proven success in violation of all basic and fundamental rules of economics and totally contrary to all the laws of capitalism. American Indians are human beings. We are supposed to be citizens of the United States of America. We fought in your wars in other countries. Our Navajo Nation code talkers served and saved this nation in World War II. We have the inalienable right to joint venture with whom we choose as long as we do not harm nor commit fraud upon anyone. The American Indian statistics of deprivation have remained constant since the end of World War II. All other groups of citizens' fortunes rise and fall with the gross national product. With the blatant genocide of our traditional people, we have less than 50,000 in America today. We are averaging a loss of 1,000 a year since 1900. We are losing a value system as distinct people that sets us apart from the industrialized world. These facts surface in our tribal statistics, and no one attempts to do anything about it except for a few social workers and reservation police. This new statistical horror is women and child abuse. Child sexual abuse is epidemic on Indian reservations, and all you hear are whispers. This abuse can be directly attributable to the schools on the reservations. Education in the BIA, public, the contract, and missionary schools do not teach positive values from non-Indian culture, and in collusion with the BIA, certainly do not allow Indian culture and values to be taught. Educators continually denigrate American Indian traditional lifestyle as primitive, dirty, and without any redeemable virtues. Congress passed the American Indian Religious Freedom Act in 1978. To date, 6 cases concerning our freedom of religion has reached the Supreme Court. We lost every one of them.
Activist Russell Means speaking to the U.S. Senate in 1989. WPFW's John Kane is the host of Let's Talk Native. Here he shares some very hard truths about November and the realities and myths around Native American Heritage Month.
Sergio, hey, it is our special month. Look, if I sound sarcastic, it's because I am. And so let me just explain it. Every November is declared or proclaimed, whatever you want to call it, by the sitting president as National Native American Heritage Month. Now, November also has the anniversary of the Canandaigua Treaty, which is on November 11th. That happens to fall on American Veterans Day. So we not only have this National Native American Heritage Month and our Treaty Day in the month, it also gets shared by things like the American Thanksgiving and Black Friday. The reason I'm so sarcastic about it is because, you know, I'm troubled by the name because it's National Native American Heritage Month. So it's always this idea of looking backwards. And we're still here. By looking backwards, in much the same way that Black History Month is celebrated, what it ends up being is more a function of America grabbing on to Black, in that case, or Native, in our case, heroes that they can, like, still promote the American way. There is very little that brings any contemporariness to our existence. So the very people who wrote the history, our history, and whitewashed that history, are the ones that will create the Native American heroes. And that, to me, is pretty problematic. But the mascot issue is kind of connected to this whole idea of creating this special month to, at least on paper, not in practice, but on paper, to acknowledge our history. It casts us as only historical figures. They don't really talk about the atrocities so much. I mean, and to the extent that they do talk about the atrocities, they'll own somebody like a Harriet Tubman or a Martin Luther King and make it sound like these guys are these, you know, examples of American exceptionalism. Not that they are fighting this, you know, this tide of racism that I wish we could talk about on our special month. Not just having somebody do some sort of Disney version of, you know, Tecumseh or Geronimo or Pocahontas or worse yet, the Happy Little Pilgrims and Happy Little Indians, scenario that they try to. They're still doing this to kids, by the way. They're still teaching them, you know, this myth of the first Thanksgiving. Let me be clear. The first proclaimed day of Thanksgiving came after the massacre of the Wampanoag. Now, keep in mind, the Wampanoag were their allies. They helped them. They helped them survive, you know, for a while. And then as the white people got greedier and greedier, the tensions grew and tensions grew. And ultimately, the son of Massasoit, Metacom, who they would later call King Philip, would become very hostile towards them. It was brutal. And in fact, it would end with Metacom being beheaded, having his head stuck on a spear, and set up as on a post in the outskirts of one of their village to send a signal to Native people. But we won't talk about terrorism, right? No, we won't talk about the use of terrorism against Native people. That is how the white folk proclaimed their first Thanksgiving.
Greg Pallast is an investigative reporter, and he's going to give us the latest on the Georgia runoff races that will determine the control of the U.S. Senate. First, Pallast, however, in recognition of the National Day of Mourning, fills us in on the crucial role of the American Native Nations vote in the presidential election and the history of the continuing Trail of Tears, the suppression of the vote of indigenous citizens.
For those of you who wanted to see Donald Trump skedaddled from the White House, this is the week you should be celebrating Thanksgiving, giving thanks to indigenous peoples for giving Biden the White House. The Native people's vote provided the margin for Biden in Wisconsin, in Nevada, and in Arizona. In Arizona, for example, the Tohono O'odham Nation voted 98% Democratic. If it were up to white people, Trump would have walked away with Arizona, but indigenous precincts in Navajo Nation lands reported 60 to 90% vote for Biden-Harris. The indigenous vote has been crucial before. In 2004, Native Nations gave John Kerry the votes he needed to win New Mexico and the presidency, but Kerry was never inaugurated because those Native votes were never counted. That's right, never counted. This is Greg Pallast reporting for the Pacifica Radio Network. Not counted. That's right. The nasty little secret of America's elections is that we don't count all the ballots. In the 2016 election, the United States Elections Assistance Commission reported that 1,913,369 votes, almost 2 million ballots, were cast and rejected, never counted. And who doesn't count? According to studies by the MIT Caltech Voting Project, the chance your vote won't get counted is 300% higher if you're Black or Hispanic or Asian American than if you're white. But in my 20 years of examining vote suppression from Florida to Ohio to Nevada, I have found no group has had more ballots rejected, spoiled, discounted, thrown away, or ignored than those cast by America's indigenous peoples. Let's go back to that 2004 Kerry Bush election. In McKinley County, New Mexico, which is 75% Navajo, in their 9 precincts, only 1 in 10 voters voted for president, leaving their ballot choice blank. Or at least that's the official story. That's what the tallies show. Indeed, all over the Southwest, American Natives by the tens of thousands are to this day supposedly seized with indecision when confronted with a choice in the voting booth. Coincidentally, Natives register more than 7-1 Democratic. Or maybe that's not a coincidence when the GOP counts indigenous votes. For example, in a special precinct in dirt-poor Doña Ana County, created to collect absentee ballots from soldiers overseas, almost all of them indigenous or Latinx soldiers, not a single American soldier listed a choice for their commander-in-chief. 100% blank, not one soldier voted for President of the United States. At least that's the official count. I reached out to New Mexico's Secretary of State, Becky Vigil-Hron, on her cell phone while she was driving to the state capitol from Albuquerque. I asked her about the missing indigenous and Hispanic military votes. The Secretary of State told me, well, a lot of these people can't make up their minds. That's a quote. Bottom line, if you're Native American, the chance your ballot will not be counted for some technical reason is 1,200% higher than if you're white. Not counting indigenous votes is as American as apple pie. But it doesn't have a long history because indigenous peoples were not even granted American citizenship until 1924. American movies celebrated the bravery of Ira Hayes, a Marine from the Pima Reservation in Arizona who won the World War II Victory Medal for his bravery. Although wounded, he was one of the soldiers who famously lifted the American flag above Iwo Jima. The war hero returned to Arizona, where, like other indigenous peoples, he was not even allowed to vote. That is, until 1948. But it's not like Arizona welcomes those American Native votes today, especially because they are measurably the most progressive voting group in America. According to one survey, 9% of all indigenous people in Arizona consider themselves democratic socialists. They don't lack the will to vote, but they often lack addresses. In reservation areas and remote pueblos, many lack the formal street addresses required by the Patriot Act for voting. A reservation address might be 5 miles south of the gas station. That won't get you a ballot. But it can get you COVID. Navajo counties have some of the highest COVID rates in the nation. That's one reason why Arizona tribal lawyers joined the legal fight against Republicans attempting to impede mail-in voting. And let's talk about the vote. Donald Trump has one last gambit to deny the franchise to not only indigenous voters, but to all of us. How? By getting three states, either Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, or Pennsylvania, not to certify the vote. Under the U.S. Constitution, Article 2, state legislatures, not voters, choose the electors for the Electoral College. If legislators say there are too many fraudulent ballots, too many so-called fraudulent voters, they can refuse to certify the winner for that state. The result? Neither Biden nor Trump will get 270 electoral votes in the Electoral College. What happens then? Well, under Amendment 12 to the Constitution, it goes to the House of Representatives. And no, Nancy Pelosi does not pick the president out of her sorting hat. It's one state, one vote. California gets one vote, same as South Dakota. And then, because the Republicans control 26 state delegations, Trump would be re-elected constitutionally. And that's why Alex Jones was in Georgia. Palace Investigative Fund reporter Zach D. Roberts was in Atlanta, where Alex Jones and a screaming pack of white nationalists were putting the heat on Republican Governor Brian Kemp not to certify the vote in Georgia. Here's Zach Roberts.
As I rolled by the rally, a Christian white nationalist and anti-immigrant group led by Nick Fuentes, called the Groypers, were chanting, USA, USA.
If they can't protect President Trump, then they are good for nothing.
And their vision of America first seems to exclude the first Americans, the voters who, despite massive suppression, put Biden over the top. This week, you can give thanks to indigenous peoples. But don't blame them if Biden turns out to be a turkey. This is Greg Palast in Los Angeles for the Pacifica Radio Network.
That was Greg Palast. Catch his reports on Pacifica's Election Crimes Bulletin and also at gregpalast.com. And this concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates for contributing to this and other editions of the show. Today's show was co-produced and edited by Jacqueline Baptiste and Akua Holt, with production and editing assistance by Paulina Vasiliev and producer Ken Yale. Special thanks to our co-executive producers, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening. I am Obidike Kamau.